Welcome back to the High Functioning Disaster, where we talk honestly about life's chaos and the courage it takes to heal through it. I'm your host, Sasha Holder. Today kicks off a three-part conversation with Amy Vince, a health and wellness professional with more than 20 years of experience and 16 years working with clients through EFT tapping, a powerful mind-body practice that helps release stuck emotions and resolve the roots of anxiety, stress, and trauma. In part one, we're unpacking the difference between big T and little T trauma, why coping strategies like perfectionism, people-pleasing, or addiction often form in childhood, and how to move from simply managing our emotions to truly healing them. Amy also shares a simple table and legs metaphor that makes sense of complex trauma and reminds us that even our most confusing behaviors usually start as our brain's attempt to keep us safe. Content note, this episode includes general references to trauma and abuse, but not graphic detail. Let's dive in. Amy, welcome. I'm so excited to dive into this topic with you. So you've said before that healing is possible even when trauma feels lifelong. What drew you into this work?
I've always been a very curious person about myself and why I do certain things and why other people respond certain ways. And so I've always just found human behavior very fascinating for me. So what drew me to this work was, of course, my own suffering and my own healing process that needed to happen in my life. And for whatever reason, I immediately recognized tapping as a really powerful tool for me at the time. I think intuitively, there was a part of me that always placed an emphasis on the emotional side of things. And that's where I gravitate. And this tapping tool really addresses the emotional aspect as well as physical and intellectual aspects, but it really centers on the emotional aspect. And so that I think I was immediately drawn to it for that reason.
That's really interesting. So when you talk about little T and big T trauma. So can you walk us through those, like how you define them, and then why do some people come out of trauma with socially acceptable coping mechanisms and then some are more consider more self-destructive behaviors?
Yeah. Okay. There are big T and little T traumas, as you said. Big T trauma, I would define that as any huge event in your upbringing, your adult life. It could be like a big car accident or a sexual or physical assault. It could be a really intense health diagnosis. It could be a parent passing away, depending on your relationship with them. So there's a lot of different things that could be lumped into the big T trauma category. But I want to give it a caveat and say it's big T, and usually it only happens a couple times in your life, if at all. Most of the time it's once. Sometimes it's a couple times. If it happens more than that, say there's physical or sexual assault, you know, throughout years in your childhood or something, then it becomes more complex. But if we're just saying in general, big T trauma is one big event. Little T trauma tends to be something like having an angry parent or a sibling in the household growing up and feeling very afraid that if you did anything to upset them, that you could be in a threatening situation, in a dangerous situation, something that feels unsafe. And so for years or even decades, you learn to walk on eggshells. You learn to keep the peace. You learn to be a people pleaser, and maybe even a perfectionist throughout all of that in an effort to stay safe. So little T traumas are often not even recognized by people as trauma. And most people, including myself, grew up thinking I didn't have any trauma because I wasn't beaten. And I did have a roof over my head and I did have food on the table whenever I was hungry. But little T trauma, especially because it tends to happen over a longer period of time, many, many times, sometimes hundreds or thousands of times, it can be so much more complex and more difficult to identify and release and heal because there are so many different aspects to it. When I think about releasing something with tapping, I think about it like a tabletop. And Gary Craig, one of the founders, used to describe it this way too. A tabletop. Think of people pleasing as a tabletop. And there are all these legs underneath the table holding it up. And we use tapping to break off each one of the legs. And if it's a complex trauma, something that has happened over many years or decades, there might be 100 legs underneath that table that we need to address. But if it's like a big T trauma, you know, something with only one or two, maybe three or four legs at the most, it's simpler. I don't think it's easy. It's simpler to collapse that table and make the emotional connection to it, to make that neutralized so that it is no longer affecting our current behavior today. So does that make sense?
Yes. I have a follow-up question to when you said big T trauma. Mm-hmm. If it's something that is a big T trauma and it does happen multiple times, you said like sexual assault or abuse that happens over the course of years, like when you're growing up, it becomes more complex. Can you talk about how that becomes more complex? What does that mean?
In similar way to like a little T trauma, because it happens so often over a period of time, it becomes a complex trauma. And it does the same thing in the big T trauma category, but it tends to manifest itself a little bit differently and a little bit more intensely. I would think along the lines of depressive and anxiety disorders, or bipolar, or, you know, something along those lines, OCD. It tends to have these bigger diagnoses that go along with it. Not always the case. I mean, everybody's an individual situation, but in general, that can be what happens. And it's still like the tabletop. If it's a big T trauma and there are 100 or more legs underneath it, it's going to take some time and some intense work to deal with it. But if it's just a one or two time thing, then it's generally a lot simpler and faster by far.
Yes. And as you mentioned, that doesn't mean that it's easy. Mm-mm. There are just not as many legs to dismantle.
Exactly.
Exactly. So is that the reason that some people come out of their trauma with more socially acceptable mechanisms or coping mechanisms or no?
You know, it's funny. I think everybody chooses what makes the most sense for them in a moment. I don't think that trying to think around what I'm saying, but really, I didn't have a choice when I chose food as my coping mechanism. I just kind of turned to it when I needed comfort and I didn't know what else to do. And I think that's how we adapt to a scary or dangerous situation. We just turn to whatever feels most comfortable in that moment. So when I turned to food, I needed a distraction. I needed to get out of my head and out of my worries. And I used that as a distraction. Now, I also had other coping mechanisms that included people pleasing, which gave me positive feedback throughout my life, but also left me feeling completely empty. You know, at the end of the day, when I have pleased everybody else but myself, and I have said yes too many times and not elevated my own needs above anybody else's. So that left me feeling really empty and really, just like a puddle on the floor with no structure to myself. So they all have a great cost. Some of them are more socially acceptable than others, and the cost is something that we don't often see. So being a perfectionist is a really, really great quality to have in certain environments, and a lot of people would receive incredibly positive feedback around that. And there is a great cost that comes with that kind of behavior. And so I guess it's up to the individual to decide, is the cost too great? Is this something that I want to work through? Or do I consider that a defining characteristic and part of my identity that I value?
That makes a lot of sense, because we do, particularly when we're children, because we lack the ability to reason fully, our brains are not fully developed, that we reach for whatever, I don't know if it's innate drives or what, but we just grab something and see if it works.
Yeah, we're just trying to self-soothe. That's it. We're just trying to self-soothe and stay safe. Those are the driving forces.
Yes. 100%. And thinking about my own self, like being a child, I know that, like you, I gravitated to food. And I think the first time that I did that, I was a small child. And I'm not really sure how old I was. If I had to guess, I would say maybe 3 or 4. And I remember that my parents were fighting, but my parents were divorced, and I don't remember my dad living with us. I have an older brother, and he's enough years older than I am that he does have these memories. But I just remember that my parents were arguing. It wasn't violent. It was just loud. And I was afraid, and I didn't know what to do. I was in my room, and I just remember going to the kitchen and opening the refrigerator. And, you know, a little kid, I'm little, and I was a small child, not just young, but small physically. Yeah. And all I saw, all I can remember seeing, is a package of bacon, raw bacon, with you know, the plastic, or the styrofoam tray with the plastic. And I remember opening that plastic, sticking my finger in it and pulling it back and grabbing a piece of raw bacon and scurrying off to my room and hiding behind my dresser and eating that piece of raw bacon. And to this day, I do not like bacon. If that's what we have, sort of thing, like if somebody's, you know, has us over and we're having like BLTs or something, or, you know, if that's just happens to be what we're having for dinner, then I'll grin and bear it. Right. But
yeah,
I am never going to pick bacon.
Yes. I totally get that. Your little girl, 3 years old, she doesn't she doesn't have all the information, you know, to make a sound, logical decision and try and understand what's happening around her. She hears loud, angry voices. And of course, she just wants somebody to go like this. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah. And that was the way you chose in that moment. And I just have so much compassion for that little girl. Like, she just didn't have all the information. She didn't have enough perspective to understand what was going on. You know, of course you did that. Of course you did that. That makes total sense to me. Yeah.
It does make a lot of sense now that I'm older and I can think more critically and reason, like looking back, like, well, I was just trying to help me and get through that situation. And as a child that small, we don't have language skills, vocabulary. We don't know how to say what we need because we don't really know what we need. And I know that I did the best I could with what I had in the moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the problem comes in because we don't know when it stops being a threat. That's the problem. We get scared in a moment, and then our subconscious mind will constantly be scanning the horizon for another threat just like that. So you hear a loud argument off in the distance, or even somebody raising their voice, they're getting frustrated, maybe not even angry at you. Mm-hmm. But your subconscious mind gets triggered by that. 99% of the time, you don't even recognize it, but you get triggered. Your amygdala fires off a bunch of cortisol in your body, and you are instantly in fight or flight mode. And you don't even know it. You don't even know it. That's your subconscious mind constantly scanning. And a lot of the time, it's irrational. It can't look at a situation and go, that's not actually a threat to me. It just hears the loud voices because that's what the part of your brain remembers was the trigger for you in that moment. Right? I mean, it's so crazy the way our subconscious mind works and what it does to try and protect us.
That is wild.
Yeah, that's all it's ever trying to do is protect us. Like, all the things that we label as really bad behavior, like procrastination or addiction or, you know, anything along those lines, that's all our subconscious mind trying to shut down the threat, whatever it is, from the past or worrying about the future. It's trying to shut it down. And if your mode of being in fight or flight mode is to freeze, then you procrastinate. If your mode of being in fight or flight mode is to, like, be in somebody's face, then you'll have like an anger issue. And if it's to run, then maybe you can't commit to anything because it feels too scary for you to do that. I mean, it just shows up however your chosen mode of fight or flight mode is.
That's really wild. I can envision people that I know with different, like as you're speaking, people with anger issues. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, because I know their stories, that makes sense.
And they're in fear. It doesn't show up looking like fear, but that's what it is.
That's wild.
Yes. Yes.
So when someone freezes, how is that?
Because in nature, fighting or fleeing or freezing are all totally acceptable responses. I mean, in nature, you've seen like animals or whatever, they freeze. And because they're not moving, they often aren't even seen anymore as prey.
Same
with running. Sometimes you can run out of the way and get yourself safe. And sometimes you can turn and fight and make yourself safe. All are totally acceptable responses in nature. It it shows up differently for adults, and some are praised and mm-hmm. some are judged and criticized, but they're all natural in nature.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I beat myself up for years because I freeze. I get paralyzed and I can't do anything. And I labeled myself as lazy and, you know, fill in the blank. But the truth is, it was a perfectly acceptable response given my upbringing and all of the things that went along with it.
Gotcha. So is procrastination, how does that one fall in? Is it a freeze or a flight? Because to me, it seems like a little bit of both.
It might have a little bit of both aspects to it, but I'll just tell you my personal situation. I was a big procrastinator, and I would make a bunch of different goals, things I knew that I wanted, and then I would find myself paralyzed and unable to move forward, and it didn't make sense because I'm like, I say I want this. Why am I not, you know, doing the steps that it takes to get there? And so I asked myself, what would happen if I did go after this? And then the answer came that that opened up the possibility that I could fail if I actually moved forward on it and didn't and tried and then failed. Somehow that felt worse. And then I'd asked myself, well, okay, but a lot of people say that failure is one more step towards success. So you continue to fail and then you find the right way to succeed eventually. And it's a good thing. It's a learning experience and it's supposed to happen. All the successful people go through these periods of failure in order to find their success. And so I asked myself, why does it feel so horrible to the idea of failure? And the answer occurred to me that, well, that would prove my worst fears about myself true, that there was something wrong with me and that I wasn't worthy or deserving of good things. And then I asked myself, well, why do I think that? And the answer came immediately. Well, it's because your dad left when you were 4 years old. And that was what your little girl decided, was that there was something wrong with you at that moment. And I have been continuing to look through the world with that lens on ever since. So in a moment, my symptom and my coping mechanism is procrastination and paralysis. But what my subconscious mind is scanning the horizon for is ways that I could prove that there's something wrong with me, and I would avoid those things at all costs, because that was the trauma. My dad leaving, and that was the fear and the limiting belief that resulted from it. So that's how it shows up. It also showed up with food addiction. And I would immediately turn to food anytime I started feeling anxious or scared. So I would get in paralysis and then I would go eat and try and soothe myself. But it was all the same thing, all the same source.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And thank you for sharing that part of your story. So you said previously when we had a discussion that many people come in naming only anxiety or stress. Why do we stop there instead of asking what's underneath? And what's the difference between managing emotions versus actually healing them?
Good question. I think people don't know how to name their emotions. I don't think that we have been taught. I don't think that we have been encouraged to understand them and try and name them or even talk about them in a really meaningful way, unless they are wonderful, happy emotions. We have typically been led in the opposite direction. So if we get into an uncomfortable emotional state, there's typically somebody there telling us it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. You know, whatever, it'll be fine in the end, whatever the words are. And they're trying to steer us away from actually experiencing our emotions in some way, shape, or form. And I mean, it's been that way for hundreds of years. We, as women, we were labeled hysterical if we had anything other than, you know, calm, accommodating emotions happening for us. And as men, if it's anything other than anger that they're experiencing, then they are considered weak. So across the board, we have never been encouraged to lean into them and really get curious about what we're feeling. So we get to this point in our society today, and for the most part, people don't know how to label what they're feeling. So the overarching label is stress and overwhelm. And in general, I can tell you that we are in fight or flight mode, I would say upwards of 80 to 90% of the time. Like, because we just have never been taught how to deal with our emotions. So we feel some sort of fear or feeling and we immediately do something else. And so that buildup happens over time. And it's just like, you know, a bucket that gets filled to the rim, and sometimes it just starts to overflow. Like, and we don't have the ability to manage it well anymore. So we've been stuffing it away for years and, you know, avoiding and denying, but it doesn't go anywhere until we actually engage with it. And what I mean by engaging with it versus managing it would be like experiencing like anxiety, maybe shortness of breath, or maybe your heart is racing, or maybe your palms are sweaty, something like that. Not being able to name what it is that you're feeling really other than those physical symptoms. And so you have learned that you can just take some deep breaths and kind of bring your heart rate back down, or something like that. Or even tapping. You can tap in a moment and you can lower your cortisol and get yourself back to a place where you can function. And I would call that managing. Healing your emotions requires you to actually feel them. And that means not just thinking about them, not intellectualizing emotions, which is what I think we're mostly taught to do, to try and understand them and kind of dissect them a little bit. Well, why do I feel this way? But actually just sitting with the sensation of sadness in our heart, or sitting with the sensation of fear in our belly and really feeling it, stopping the thought process that happens and bringing our awareness down into our body and really feeling it. If we do that, like, it really only takes 90 seconds or less of feeling an emotion for it to start to dissipate immediately. But we have never been taught to do that, never been encouraged to do that. And we are so far from that right now that even the mention of turning into our uncomfortable emotions and leaning into them makes people really uncomfortable. Emotions have been judged and criticized so much over the years that it puts us in an extremely vulnerable position to just feel our emotions, which happen every single day. And not all of them are positive. And if we don't feel them, they just build up in our system.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's important to recognize that all of our feelings, regardless of what it is, they're valid. We're feeling them for some reason. We don't just feel things just because we want to on a whim. They're valid. And so I think it's important that we recognize that they're not good or bad. They just are. They're there, right. and they're okay to have. It's part of being human. So for someone listening who feels like their trauma is too big or too small to matter, what would you want them to know?
I would just encourage them to lean in. It's really, really scary, but I have had so many transformational moments in my life when I have turned into my trauma and looked at it and engaged with it and felt it and got to the other side of it, that tremendous amount of relief that happens when you do that is so profound. Like I just want everybody to be able to experience that, whether it's a big or a small trauma. I guarantee you it is affecting you in a negative way and in some way in your life. It is preventing you from having balance. Maybe it's preventing you from having good physical health, but it is getting in the way somehow. And I just encourage everybody to explore it. Explore the possibility that there's a pot of gold on the other side of this, and have the courage to lean in enough, long enough, and be disciplined enough to get to the other side at least. Because when you do, that's when, gosh, things open up. The world opens up. You have so much more space around you, so much more capacity for compassion and love for yourself, love for other people. Like, it just opens up areas of your life that you probably never thought possible.
Phew, big T, little T, and everything our brains do to keep us safe. Today we talked about how coping shows up, perfectionism, people-pleasing, procrastination, addiction, and Amy's table and legs metaphor for dismantling long-standing patterns. We also touched on the difference between managing emotions and actually feeling them long enough to start healing. Next time, we're digging into generational trauma, what we inherit, what we experience, and why Amy says, "It wasn't my fault, but it is my burden to heal." If this episode helped, share it with a friend and follow the High Functioning Disaster so part two lands in your feed. And a quick resource note, Amy's offering listeners 50% off the first year of her Soar with Tapping app. Grab the code at soarwithtapping.com/podcast-special. I'll put the information and details in the description and show notes. See you in part two. Oh, and one last thing. The content shared on the High Functioning Disaster is for informational and conversational purposes only and is not intended as professional, medical, or mental health advice. Everyone's situation is unique, and what we talk about here may not apply to your specific circumstances. Please do what's right for you and always consult with a qualified professional for medical, mental health, financial, or legal guidance. You take care of you, boo. See you next time.